Well, we begin six sermons on Genesis 1 through 11. And as I'm sure you already know, there are a lot of odd and spectacular elements in these 11 chapters. Let's just consider some of them. There is a God who can speak things into existence. And yet there are two different creation accounts, which, taken at a superficial level, don't agree with each other on all the details. There is a paradise, a garden of delight, in which a man and a woman are well fed and naked and unashamed. There is a talking serpent who's also walking, evidently, because part of the curse is that he now has to crawl on his belly. There's a tree with some pretty spectacular fruit. If you eat it, you get moral knowledge. That's packed with omega-3s. Another one will give you eternal life if you eat it. There are men in these chapters who live for close to 1,000 years, one of whom, at least, is still fathering children at the age of 500. I know it seems old, we can hear Noah explaining to his neighbors, but when little Japheth graduates from high school, I'll still only be 518. We have a global flood that lasts for over a year, and at its peak, anyway, covers every mountaintop. And we have a remarkable cruise ship that saves some humans and some animals and a lot of fertilizer. There is an ambitious architectural scheme that I'm thinking of, the Tower of Babel, that ends up bringing linguistic confusion to the whole world. And I suspect this is probably the first time somebody thought, we ought to have zoning bylaws. And we have a preoccupation with genealogies and with family histories that would put the most devoted Ukrainian Mennonite to shame. And so it's little wonder that most commentaries can't even agree what to call these chapters, these first 11 chapters. It's very clear what's happening once we get to chapter 12. We have patriarchal history. We have the story of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all. And so then we know what we're reading. We know what's going on. But the first 11 chapters, what shall we call these? These extraordinary things. Some words that I have come across in my research. A biblical prelude. A biblical prologue. Primeval history. Pre-history. Another thing. To cover 11 chapters in 6 weeks, I should be covering two chapters per Sunday. But I'm going to be spending the first two Sundays covering only chapter one. So those are the first two, and that's actually the reciprocal of the rate at which I should be going. For those of you following along. The third sermon will be a look at the garden in chapter 2. The fourth Sunday will be on the fall in chapter 3. That takes us up to Thanksgiving. I won't be speaking on Thanksgiving. And after Thanksgiving, there will be two sermons during which we'll look at everything else. I am spending two Sundays on Genesis 1 because I think it's absolutely foundational to just about everything else that follows in the entire Bible, not just Genesis 1 through 11. And this morning, we're going to focus on how the literature in chapter 1 compares with other quite similar literature and mythologies that are found in ancient Near Eastern texts that have been unearthed on stone tablets. We'll come back to that later. Next week, I'm going to be exploring more just what it is that Genesis 1 proclaims. It's almost like a liturgy. Genesis chapter 1, and we actually had a kind of a Eugene Peterson message version of that liturgy from the Dirksen family. But we'll actually read it, if all goes well, all of us, together as a liturgy next week. But before we begin the series, I want to establish two general principles, which will, at least so you know, be guiding me through these 6 weeks. And the first is in regard to the term literal interpretation. As I'm sure you know, there's an awful lot of discussion about literal interpretation when it comes to the opening chapters of Genesis. And I would like to actually reclaim the phrase literal interpretation to mean something other than what it commonly means. Commonly, when you hear someone talking about a literal interpretation of Genesis, it usually refers to a kind of reading of the text that is, quite frankly, superficial. It's a reading that is glaringly and stubbornly uninterested in context. And to give you an example of what I mean that's not from Genesis, consider a sentence from Psalm 104. He set the earth on its foundations. It can never be moved. Now, in the time of Galileo, there were some in the church, by no means not all in the church, but there were some who read that sentence in the way that I mean, superficially and without taking any consideration to context. And they kind of jumped in, read the sentence, jumped back out and said, see that? The meaning is clear. It means what it means. The earth doesn't move. So all these scientists talking about the earth moving around the sun are just trying to undermine the Bible and trying to remove God from society. Does that sound familiar? But the truth is that that sentence was in a psalm, which is a poem. And that is a poem that is replete with all kinds of metaphors, one of which was God as builder and earth as temple. And a good builder puts a temple on a foundation so that it doesn't move. That's just one aspect of being a good builder. So God is a good builder, and the earth is a special place. That, I contend, is the literal meaning of that sentence in the Psalms. The literal meaning is what was intended and what would have been understood by the original listeners. And that's how I want us to think about what a literal interpretation of Genesis would be. A literal interpretation of the early chapters of Genesis is one that strives to hear the text as it was intended to be heard by the original author, by the original storyteller. And I'll put it another way. We should ask ourselves, how would this have been understood by those who first heard it? What would have struck them as important and crucial? So rather than a superficial, context-free understanding, we should be aiming for an understanding of these early chapters that does require some work on our part. Which reminds me of a sentence from the Epistle, 1 Corinthians. Paul, this is the love chapter. And in it, there are actually two sentences. Here they are. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put childish ways behind me. Seeking how the original hearers would have understood the passage is a grown-up way of approaching the text. It does require some work. We need to put childish ways behind us. And that brings me to the second principle that will be guiding me as I put this series together. It seems to me that especially when it comes to the early chapters of Genesis, there are two major kinds of errors that the church makes. The first is not allowing our children to be children. I'll come back and explain what I mean by that in a second. And the other error is not encouraging our adults to grow up. Not allowing children to be children. What I mean by that is there are far too many of us adults who look at the story of Noah and are horrified. And so we skip over it. We don't want our children to read this. Think of all the poor camels that didn't make it on, etc. But our children are, in general, not horrified. Our children understand story. They have a natural ability to absorb what they need to absorb and to just sort of throw off what they can't absorb. We need to trust childhood. We need to trust the power of stories. And these stories are powerful art. And powerful art does its work despite us. We need to allow the children to be children. Another way we need to allow the children to be children with these texts is this. We need to not rush to take away what may be a simplistic, superficial understanding of these texts before children have any cognitive skills to replace them with anything. To rush a particular person in a text and say, may not be a historical person, this may be an archetype, and say that to a 7-year-old? All you've done is take away a story and not given anything back. Not until we are ready to understand what an archetype is should we be doing that. So the first mistake I think we can make is rush and not allow children to be children with these texts. The second mistake that we make is not encourage the adults to grow up. If we never actually reach the point where we're discussing what an archetype is, especially with these early chapters of Genesis, we're really doing ourselves a disservice, and we're not getting to the real meaning of some of these texts. Now, the problem for me is we're not all high school age and up here. And so I need to be very, very careful not to take away something when there's nothing to replace it. So you adults out there, those who have ears to hear, let them hear. I will be, when necessary, dropping some hints and being fairly cryptic when I feel that taking away a certain understanding of the story would be dangerous for young people. And hopefully you will understand what I'm saying when I'm saying it. And if not, and you need to push me and get more explicit conversation about these matters, that's what the adult Sunday school, I think, will be for. Because I just want to be very careful about that. Okay, now, having said all that, we're going to turn and look at Genesis chapter 1. This week will be more sort of the mechanics of the text. And next week will be more, I don't know what the right word is, devotional, sort of looking at what the text proclaims and how wonderful and joyous it is for us as people of faith. But this week, a more dry approach perhaps. But I think one that is required if we're to understand what it is we're reading in Genesis chapter 1. So, to the passage, which I won't take time to read aloud this week because I'm hoping we will all read it aloud together next week. But I think you're pretty familiar with it. 6 days of creation and the 7th day of rest. What kind of literature is this? Is it poetry? And the reason we have to ask what kind of literature it is because we need to know how to approach it, how to read it. Well, it's not poetry, really. Not most of it, except there is one explicit moment of poetry. Here it is. So God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. I love that when it talks about us as male and female, you just can't do anything but break into poetry. And in the very next chapter, when Adam first sees Eve, that's the next time there's explicit poetry in Genesis. He just can't help himself. The first time he sees her, he breaks into poetry. We've been doing that for a long time. However, although not explicitly poetry, the entire text is poetic in a way. There are all sorts of repetitions structuring the passage. And God said, and it was so. God saw that it was good. It was evening and there was morning, the 2nd day, 3rd day, 4th day. Let's take a look at this structure. And at this point, I need to do publicly what I've been doing privately and apologize to those of you who were here for the public lecture I gave a year and a half ago. Titled Creation and Evolution, Thinking Them Together. And for a chunk of that lecture, I spent time doing exactly what you're going to hear this morning. And I tried to avoid it in the weeks that I've been thinking about this sermon, and I felt like sort of Jonah trying not to go to Nineveh. But I just sort of had a crisis last night and realized I can't avoid this. And so it is a repeat, and I'm sorry. I'd like to thank Louisa for breaking that in this morning. Opening sentences are crucially important. And in Genesis, the very first sentence is easy for us to understand. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. A very clear topic sentence. But the very next sentence, have you ever wondered? It's a bit odd. The earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. What waters? We'll come back to those deep dark, chaotic waters in a moment. But for now, notice that we have been given in the very second sentence two problems. One is that the earth is formless, and the other, the earth is empty. So we have formlessness and emptiness. And a quick look at this overhead shows that this is exactly what structures what follows. It's not a throwaway sentence as the author tried to think of how to start. You know, those bunch of opening paragraphs when you write an essay that are really bad and you're going to go back and delete them anyway, but you have to get started. It was formless and empty and... Okay, day one. It's not like that. This is an important sentence. In the first 3 days, God fixes the formlessness problem by creating categories, an order. And in the second 3 days, God fixes the emptiness problem by filling up those categories. And notice how the filling up corresponds to the categories. You just look at the chart, it's very, very clear. Right? Light, sun, moon, and stars. Fills that up. So, one more thing. I have added on day 5 and day 6 extra things that get added to the liturgy, if you will. Suddenly on day 5 we get added to all the repetition, be fruitful and multiply, and that is repeated on day 6. And on day 6 there are all sorts of other things too. Rule, humans are told, over the earth, over all the earth and over all the creatures. And here's your food. And it's very good, we hear for the first time on day 6. So there's a real climax of sorts that happens on day 6. All right. Would you mind turning that off? Thanks. Although if I can't compete with that boring thing, I don't know. Genesis 1 isn't exactly poetry then, but it's also not exactly prose. It is somewhere in between, and we will come back to that. Is Genesis 1 straightforward history then, as we understand the term in the 21st century? Now, if the answer is yes to that question, then we have some problems. We have to deal with the fact that there are 3 evenings and 3 mornings, in a sense, 3 days before the sun shows up, which in general helps us define what a day is. And if we insist on reading all the opening chapters of Genesis as straightforward history, we have to come, as I've said, we have to come to terms with the fact that there are 2 different accounts that don't exactly agree. As an example, in the second account, which starts in Genesis 2 verse 4, neither shrub nor plant appear on the earth until after humans, but in the first chapter, they're around 3 days before humans. So, while the passage in Genesis 1 certainly focuses on the past, it isn't straightforward history. Or if it is straightforward history, as we understand the term, then there are some serious challenges. All right then, is Genesis 1 myth? Now, if by that we mean simply fiction, then of course it isn't. The first hearers of this story certainly would not have understood this story as a pleasant diversion to pass the long winter. However, the passage does have some elements of mythology in it, in its content, in its style. In fact, as we will see in just a moment, and this will be very important this morning, it's probably the most important point that I'll be trying to make this morning. Genesis 1 is explicitly making use of the mythology of other cultures. Next, is Genesis 1 science? If by that we mean something like our modern science, the answer does have to be no. Our science is focused solely on the natural realm, on theories that explain and allow us to predict events in nature. And Genesis 1 isn't doing this. However, there is a kind of science in Genesis 1. We see in it the science of the ancient world. We can see in the text the common assumption in the ancient world that there is another set of waters above the sky, and that the sun and the moon and the stars are actually in the sky. And the reasoning for this is quite straightforward. It rains. Rain is water. Where does it come from? And there must be a lot of water up there. And in fact, the firmament is firm and it holds the water up. And so between those waters and these waters, we have the sun and the moon and the stars, not very high up off the ground actually, lighting things up. That's the ancient world's science. That's the common assumption. And we see it in Genesis 1. So we can read Genesis 1 as science, but if we do, we've got problems, and we probably shouldn't take any more airplane trips, just in case. Now, Genesis 1, then, as you can see, is a little bit difficult to pin down. It's poetic, but not poetry. It's historical, but not history. It's mythological, but it's not simply myth. It's scientific, but not science. So what is it? And I'm not going to answer that question yet. Give my answer to that question, which may very well be flawed, until we answer another question, and that is, how would it have been understood by the Israelites who first heard it? What would they have taken it to be? Now, the traditional view is that Moses is the author of this passage, but the authorship question is incredibly complex, probably unanswerable. So today, for convenience, I'm going to follow Bruce Waltke, and I'm going to speak of Moses as the author of the original material, acknowledging that later Hebrews polished and reworked the text. And next week, I'm actually going to talk about the context of those polishers, who are most likely living during the Babylonian exile, and what we can learn from that context. But for this week, let's just think about Moses as the leader of a newly freed people, giving them what they need to know. Think about Moses. We know he was politically responsible for the Israelites, right? He negotiated with Pharaoh, he led them to freedom, he administered the social safety net for 40 years in the wilderness. And we know that he was religiously responsible for the Israelites as he constantly mediated between a stubborn people and a frustrated God. But what we often forget, and I think this is important this morning, is that Moses was also responsible for developing a new worldview in a group of people just recently freed from slavery. Remember that for all their lives and for generations before them, the Israelites had been things and not persons. They had been valued only so far as they were useful. They had, literally, no free time. They were slaves. And so they were nearly defenseless against whatever the prevailing Egyptian culture and worldviews might be. In short, they didn't know much, if anything, about who they were, who God was, or what nature was. And everything Moses did, leading them out of Egypt in a cloud of miracles, telling them about their God, writing down their laws and histories, and taking them to the brink of the promised land, all of this can be seen under the same job description, worldview formation. In all of his work, Moses was taking what had been an empty people and was filling them up with the good news of who they were, who God was, and what nature was. Genesis 1 is a crucial part of that work. It is a creation story, so its task is to answer some of, if not the, biggest questions we humans can ask. What is God like? What is this place? What are we? Why are we here? And remember that it's only once these big questions are addressed that any of the smaller yet important ideas like covenant or law can begin to make any sense. You can't have a covenant with a God if you have no idea who that God is or who you are. Now, what wasn't fully understood until somewhat recently is that Genesis 1 is not entirely unique. Lots of ancient Near Eastern creation stories, chiseled into stone or clay tablets, have been discovered and deciphered over the past 150 years. And you can see, actually, some examples of that at the museum until the end of September. There's even one little piece that they allow you to hold, a piece of clay they allow you to hold. You can see little cuneiform little things in it. It's not a creation story. I think it's a tally of how many goats so-and-so has. But still, you get the idea. And you can see this stuff at the museum, as I say, until the end of September, end of this month. Now, these things have only been discovered, as I say, and they've been discovered for a long time, but they've only been deciphered for the last 150 years. And what I find quite interesting, I don't know what to make of it, is that this ability to read these things showed up at the exact same time, essentially, that Darwin published Origin of Species, 150 years ago, in other words, we received both a challenge to and a help to our understanding of Genesis 1. A kind of a wake-up call and a way, something to wake up to. Now, many of these ancient stories would have been available to Moses as he grew up and was educated in the luxury of Pharaoh's court. While these stories have many similarities to the creation account in Genesis, there are significant differences. So in order to hear Genesis 1 the way the Israelites would have, we're going to briefly explore three examples of these other creation stories. This will allow us to understand what the worldviews were like that were floating around at the time, and then in turn understand more fully what it was, just what it was that Moses gave the Israelites, and after the Israelites, us. So first, an Akkadian creation story. This is from about maybe a few hundred years before the Exodus, at a best guess anyway. As we join this story, the various gods are getting tired of all the work they have to do. So the gods come up with the idea of creating humans as a kind of a servant class. The goddess they called to inquire, the midwife of the gods, the wise Mamie. And they said, "Thou art the mother womb, the one who creates mankind. Create then the savage, the first man, and let him bear the yoke. The yoke he shall bear, the work of God, man shall bear." So the goddess goes on to create mankind out of clay mixed with the flesh and blood of a slain god. Second, a Babylonian creation story dating from about the same time. And at the beginning of this story, all that exists in the world is a swirling mass of primordial chaotic water. Does that sound familiar? And then out of this water, this chaotic water, gods emerge. And it doesn't take them long to get very poorly behaved. And when gods are poorly behaved, it's really quite spectacular. Lots of murder and soap opera, including a failed uprising against the powerful god Marduk, who then says in the aftermath, "Blood I will mass and cause bones to be. I will establish a savage. Man shall be his name. Verily, savage man I will create. He shall be charged with the service of the gods, that they might be at ease." And so, one of the gods who betrayed Marduk is punished, that is, slain. And out of the blood of this slain, rebellious god, they fashioned mankind. Our third story will be from Egypt, and it concerns the sun god Re. But first, you should know that each temple site in Egypt had its own creation story. And they all went something like this. At first, there's nothing but chaotic, dark, primordial water. Again. Then a primary hill rises up out of the soup, and gods set up shop on this hill, and from there, creation, the rest of creation occurs. And each city had its own story, celebrating its own hill upon which its own temple was built. So, to our Egyptian story. The sun god Re appears on a hill, and he says this, "I came into being in this land, whereas the other gods stayed in the chaotic waters. They brought to me my eye, capitalized, with them. But after I joined together my bodily members, I wept over them." And the reason why he wept is because he had forgotten to include the special eye, which has its own power and its own personality, in fact, because that is how men came into being, from the tears which came forth from my eye. It was angry with me after it returned and found that I had made another in its place. Don't you hate that? So, you have a special eye with magical powers that goes off and, I guess, looks at things. What else could it do? And it came back and saw that the god had gone on without it. And it cried, and out of those tears, we came. And another passage from Egypt, from about 2000 BC. "I brought into being the four gods from my sweat, while men are the tears of my eye." We also learn that the sun god Re descends into the chaotic underworld every night and fights against a demonic dragon there. And we only know that he's victorious when he rises again the next morning. His struggle with chaos is never finished. And this theme, this eternal struggle with chaos, also appears in Mesopotamian mythology in the lands to which the Israelites were going. Now, I just said that creation stories address some of our big, if not our biggest, questions. Now, think about how these have just been answered by these little tastes we've had of Egyptian and Mesopotamian stories. What is God like? What is this place? What are we? And why are we here? All right. Now that we've gotten a taste for the other stories, let's think about Genesis 1 as I believe it was intended to be heard, as both a cure for the Egyptian worldview the Israelites had left behind, and as a kind of vaccination against the prevailing worldviews waiting for the Israelites in the Promised Land. Genesis 1 starts just like those other stories, with primordial, chaotic waters. But after that, there are some stunning contrasts. There is only one God. Not a whole set of them busy fighting and betraying each other, as many as 600 in one Babylonian story. Humanity is not created as a servant class. In fact, the text is very clear that humanity is to rule and to subdue. Now just imagine, if you can, of course none of us can, how that would have sounded to people just freed from 400 years of slavery. You are to rule. We are not made out of the flesh or blood or tears of a slain God or an angry eye. We are not the result of violence, anger, or sadness. We are wanted. It is good that we are here. It is good that light is here, and land, and plants, and birds, and fish, and animals, good, and as we hear on day 6, very good. And what I haven't told you yet is that, in fact, there are two climaxes in this text. The first I've already mentioned, day 6, which you can tell from all the additional phrases. Day 6 is the day that we show up, so we might be tempted to say, of course that's a climax. I mean, look at us. But our arrival is actually a climax in another way. There's another contrast between Genesis and the Egyptian creation stories. In Genesis, you'll notice, there is no primary hill that rises up first from which creation occurs. Rather, in Genesis 1, it's all creation. The waters, the dry land, the creatures, the sun, moon, and stars, all of it. The Egyptian stories focus on a primary hill to explain the location of a temple. But Genesis 1 will not allow for that kind of thinking. In Genesis 1, all of creation is God's temple. Which helps us understand more fully why our arrival on day 6 is a climax. As Rick Watts points out, Rick Watts from Regent, in the ancient world, temples were constructed to resemble the cosmos. And the last thing to be put into a temple with great fanfare was the image of the god. Notice what happens in Genesis 1. No temple needs to resemble the cosmos because the entire cosmos is the temple. And the last thing to be put in it is humanity made in the image of God. That's why day 6 is a climax in the story, but there is another. The other is day 7. God doing nothing. God resting. Sabbath. Which may not, at least to those in Hollywood, look like that much of a climax. Until you consider the poor sun god, Re, fighting the chaos dragon every night. That fight is never finished conclusively. But in Genesis, God has brought order to chaos and fullness to emptiness. And God's creation has been given the freedom and the ability to go on with the work of creation. All the discussion of seeds and according to their kinds and be fruitful. For Yahweh, There is no chaos just lurking over the horizon waiting for a chance to pounce. Rather, as Ian Provin says, again from Regent, God is God and there is no contest. As a result, the world is good and will stay ordered and full. Notice that this makes science possible. The world is good and will stay ordered and full. Not only that, but given our special status as image bearers, and given what we will learn as we keep reading Genesis and Exodus, we too are called to rest, and with God, to see, to know, to love, to name, and to delight in God's good creation. This makes science desirable. So I think what we're reading in Genesis 1 is a worldview story. This is what's going on. Moses is setting down the stories that will shape God's people. They are foundational stories upon which the entire Bible rests because they answer the biggest questions. But notice that they are worldview stories. That means they are interesting. They are memorable. They are structured in a way that we can repeat them. Now, you've probably all experienced this particular phenomenon I'm about to explain. While listening to a long speech or sermon, the sound in your head, at least, goes all fuzzy. And then you hear the speaker break into a story, and the sound instantly clarifies, and you come up above the surface of the dark primordial waters, and you have no trouble staying awake or following the words, and as soon as that story is over and the speaker returns to the point, the fuzziness returns. I believe that phenomenon is a universal human experience, one of the basics, unavoidable basics of the human condition. And as a result, it is very wise that Moses developed these new worldviews through stories, like the one in Genesis 1 and in the stories that follow, employing all the available elements of poetry and history and mythology. But being a story doesn't mean it's untrue. Being a story does, however, mean that it's possible to look for truth in the wrong places. And I think this often happens to the early chapter of Genesis, and our exploration of other ancient Near Eastern stories, I hope, helps us see more clearly the point, that is, the truth, that is, the literal interpretation of Genesis chapter 1. These deep truths are about God, about nature, about humanity, and these deep truths, quite frankly, have nothing whatsoever to do with whether the days are 24-hour periods, or long periods of time, or simply ways to structure the story to make it memorable. In fact, once you see what's going on in Genesis chapter 1 as compared to the other ancient Near Eastern texts, the day issue becomes a non-issue. What is God like? What is this place? What are we, and why are we here? Genesis 1 answers clearly. God is a loving creator, successfully bringing order to chaos and fullness to emptiness. This place is, in a sense, God's temple, and it is good. We are image bearers, which means we are here to rule creation lovingly and to delight in it. That's the end of the sermon proper. Just another sentence or two as we head into communion. There's a temptation to make that an empty bumper sticker smiley face slogan at the end. Love, delight. But as we continue to read the biblical meta-narrative, we see even more clearly what God's love is like. It is not an empty smiley face bumper sticker slogan. It's a love that hurts. It's a love that gives. And that's what we're also called to do. Christ-like loving, godly loving, is not an empty smiley face. It's a love that is willing to put all sorts of things, including life, on the line for others. A love that empties itself for others. That's the love that is proclaimed in Genesis chapter 1, and that's the love we remember as we celebrate communion.